Welcome to Periodical Radio, the program about magazines and journals. I'm your host, Steve Black, librarian at the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York, and author of the book Serials in Libraries, Issues and Practices. This installment of Periodical Radio is about American Legacy, a quarterly magazine celebrating African-American history and culture. The magazine's website states that American Legacy publishes African-American history and culture, factually and positively, material that is both informative and inspirational, with content of substance, no fluff, no hype, no shallowness, but a historical chronicling of accomplishments achieved, hardships earned, obstacles overcome. The overall effect, positive and uplifting, enriching our readers' sense of being. American Legacy began publication in 1996. It is an attractive, colorful magazine enhanced with many photographs. The advertisements are predominantly full-page ads that feature images of African Americans. American Legacy is inexpensive, with a $3 newsstand price and a $9.95 annual subscription price. To learn more about American Legacy, my guest is editor Audrey M. Peterson. Audrey, welcome to Periodical Radio.
Well, thank you for having me.
Rodney J. Reynolds founded American Legacy in 1996. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little about Mr. Reynolds' motivations and ambitions for the magazine?
Sure. He founded the magazine. He actually had started several magazines more on a local basis in Cleveland. He's out of Cleveland originally. And he realized that there was definitely a market of people of color, black readers, specifically African Americans, out there that were not getting the full round of material in other media. And so he had a men's magazine at one point, and then it was sort of a family magazine, then it was a kind of Ohio-Cleveland history magazine, and he had the idea of creating a more national African-American magazine of history and culture, and worked with Forbes Inc., presented a plan, and we've been told that it was rare that they would actually go in with someone, but the plan was solid, and a lot of the basis of the plan was to distribute it for free in churches, schools, and other nonprofit institutions, because our reader base is very church-oriented in terms of the black church. And so it's a ready, set way of distribution where you have the full attention, because a lot of the congregants will listen to their pastor. So we have a full captured, captive audience. But the motivation behind the actual book itself, the magazine itself, was to bring forward a lot of the stuff that just did not get into the history books. I know as I was growing up, I'm 45 years old, and I know when I was growing up, we had teachers who added to the curriculum happily, but yeah, if you opened up any of the school books, there was not a lot of specific black history in the books. So that was our original motivation, and we're still doing that.
There's a line in your writer's guidelines that states, we like to think that black history in America is more than just the period between 1861 and 1965.
This is true.
Can you elaborate a little for us what that means?
Sure. In fact, a lot of the history that we didn't get, black history that we didn't get in the history books, is the history of when the first Africans, approximately set foot on the North American continent. And, a lot of there's this whole, couple of centuries of black history before there was a Civil War, and even prior to even the kind of antebellum slavery period that we often hear about. You had Revolutionary War, members of the Revolutionary War, and you had craftsmen, and you had pioneers, and after the civil rights movement, because it's an important time period, certainly, and we would never say that it's not, but I think that we tend to just focus on these two points, and even within those two genres and topics, there are a lot of things that we didn't hear about. Black Confederates, blacks who actually own slaves, but it was a whole different kind of situation for a black to own a slave during the antebellum period. Civil people who were a part of the civil rights who didn't necessarily, they weren't in the foreground, they were in the background. Those kind of lesser known stories.
I see. Mm-hmm. You explain that your readers, the core of your readership, are attendees of black churches. Mm-hmm. Who else are your readers? Is that exclusively the audience?
No, it's not exclusively the audience. No, we have paid subscribers, and they come from, I mean, I can tell you our demographics is about 67% female to 33% male, and the median age is like early to mid 40s is the median age, although, you know, we look at 35 plus. And it's all people of all stripes. You know, students, professionals, you know, homekeepers. Yeah, a lot of them do attend church, but we have a pretty wide audience. The people who are not of color, I get letters from them. So it's a pretty wide audience.
Do you have a sense of what portion of the audience is not individuals of color?
It's a small portion, but it's growing. It's growing. I think, you know, I get more and more letters as I've been the editor here for 9 years, and I'm getting more and more letters, and I'm pleased to get more and more letters, because that's one of the things that, you know, our mandate is to try to kind of teach people and reach people in the sense that African American and black history is inextricably intertwined with our mainstream history. And so, you know, one didn't happen without the other, and, you know, vice versa. So it's such a part of the fabric of American history that it almost sometimes feels funny kind of separating it out. But the reason it was separated out was because it was left out. So we're more and more. I mean, if you go through the pages of our magazine, you know, there are white people and the people of other, you know, races in it all the time. Because there, you can't separate that out. There would be no stories, really. And, you know, same goes for my writing staff. You know, the authors are people of many colors, many ages.
That leads me to my next question. I'd like to ask about your writers.
Uh-huh.
Your writer's guidelines suggest that instead of submitting finished articles, mm-hmm. the writer should send a 1 or 2 page proposal.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you ask for proposals instead of manuscripts?
Well, we do take manuscripts. So if you have a completed manuscript that you've already completed without, you know, any communication with me, and, hey, that would work great for American Legacy, we're always happy to read the manuscripts. But the way we work is that we make assignments. So, you know, I've had a couple of times I had to be very specific about where people have gone out, and I said, oh, you know, why don't you send a proposal? And we'll look at that, and then we'll see if we can make an assignment. And they don't really hear all of that. They go out, write the article, send it over to me, and then when can I put my invoice in? It's like we haven't even discussed anything, you know, anything really. So it's just the formal way of actually accepting an assignment. So, you know, it's the first step toward that.
Can you explain for our listeners just what the assignment process is?
Okay, yeah, sure. Usually what happens, if I don't call a writer, and I do sometimes call writers and say, look, I have this topic, I think you would be great for it, would you like to write about it, would you accept this assignment? And, it, you know, we negotiate a fee, it's this basic fee, and then... we also figure out a deadline. It's usually 3 months for us. We're a quarterly, so we figure 3 months is a goodish amount of time. And we write a little letter, an assignment letter, with sending them along with the contracts. And they sign the contracts, send them back. Within the period of time specified, they put forth they give me the manuscript. We read it. We make some adjustments sometimes, you know, and that's written into the contract that there might be a little rewriting or what have you. And once we get an okay that those adjustments can be made, then then we accept that manuscript. That manuscript is now accepted, and an invoice is put in for them to be paid for the manuscript. So it's not on publication; it's on acceptance that we pay.
I see. Let's go back to the proposal for just a moment. When someone does send a proposal, in your mind, what's the perfect proposal, one that gets you excited about carrying it through to being published in the magazine?
The proposal, first of all, it's rarely longer than a page, but sometimes it's 2 pages. But it's like a little mini story, you know, where you get a little taste of what's to come, obviously written well. I mean, if there's a typo, I'm not going to throw a perfectly good proposal away, but you can usually tell when someone hasn't really proofread. And these are writers, so if you can't write a proposal, how do I would I expect you to write an article for the magazine, you know? So, and I'm not hardcore, but I do, you know, I'm hard enough to know that it should be well-written, pretty concise, kind of give a taste of, you know, the story itself, and there should be some passion in it. I should be able to tell that this is a topic that you've been interested in. This isn't just something you pulled out of the air so that you can make some money, and that you have knowledge about it, that you have researched it, and I can tell it's research, and it's interesting because having been in this as long as I have, I can tell when things are really pulled from internet sources quickly and patched together, and when somebody has done really good primary research.
Are you on the lookout for unique stories?
Sure, and I think, you know, sometimes it's just unique in and of itself, the topic. We had one woman write a piece about a black man who was a silversmith in Philadelphia in the late 18th and early 19th century. And that's a unique story. But sometimes there's a unique twist on a story. For instance, a lot of people already know the story about Jesse Owens, who won gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. And that's a story that's been told and retold. But we have a writer who's working on a story about him and his relationship with Luz Long, who was a German track star and long jumper, who he became friends with during his time in Germany, and who he remained friends with. And there's this whole story that goes behind it. There's a behind-the-scenes story about why Jesse Owens ran and another black runner ran a relay race that two white Jewish guys were supposed to be running. You know, so there's all these little behind the scenes and little stories that can come out of something that's a well-known story too.
Do you have any other favorite stories that have been published in the magazine?
Oh, wow. That's asking a lot.
Can you share just a few?
Well, I'll tell you. It's funny. I'll tell you one of, and this was prior to my starting. I started working in the fall of 1998 at American Legacy. Prior to that, there was a story published about a man named Melvin B. Tolson, who started a debate club at a black college called Wiley College. And this debate club became so good that they toured around and they won debates with a lot of the Ivy League schools and things like that. And I always thought it was a great story. I had read it prior, like I said, to coming here. And in fact, when I did my interview for this job, one of the questions was, what are some of your favorite stories? And that was my top one. And it really pleased the editor who was interviewing me because that was her favorite too. So it might help in my favor. But it's now actually, it's been picked up by Harpo Productions. And Harpo Productions and Denzel Washington are doing a movie called The Great Debaters based on Melvin Tolson, and they actually contacted us. And it's funny because a great story is just a great story, you know, and it's just recognizable as such. They contacted us because they wanted to get in touch with the author and get some of his primary sources and that sort of thing. And so it's funny because, you know, I have my favorites, but then there are certain ones that just stand out regardless. And that's one of them. There's many, though.
Many of your articles include photographs, many historical photographs. Mm-hmm. Is getting permission from the copyright holder ever difficult for the photos that you want? Can you explain that for
us?
Yeah,
and there are pictures that didn't run because we couldn't get. For instance, we did a piece on Gordon Parks, the late, great Gordon Parks, and I did an interview with him, and it was a photo essay, and also an excerpt from his autobiography, one of his four or five autobiographies. He lived a long life, so he had to keep writing new ones. And so there was a lot on the Getty Images, Mahone's Time Life Images. So there was, he worked for Life magazine for some time. So there was a lot that they owned, and so we could license from them. And then there was a lot in the Library of Congress that were high-res publishable images that you don't they owned because he worked in the he worked at FDR's one of his Work Progress Administration programs. And I think for either the Farm Security Administration or one of those programs where they gave work to artists and other people.
But then the government owned the copyright.
Right. So the government owned the copyright,
so
and they were happy with
domain.
Letting it, yeah, in public domain. Those were fine. Then there was this one photograph that I really wanted to put in the magazine because he, you know, some of his excerpts was talking about going to Harlem at one point and becoming friendly with gang members so that he could photograph them. And this was a group, two gang members or a group of gang members fighting in the street, and he got a picture of it. Well, it resides at Art Resource. You can go to Art Resource, but they have to get permission. You have to get separate permission from the copyright holder. And at that point, it was a woman who was Mr. Parks' assistant, and it turns out, and I didn't know the backstory, she was very, very, very tied up because he was ill. And there were a lot of other things that she had to attend to, so she couldn't get back to us in time with a confirmed email or letter saying, yes, you can use this picture. And because of that, Art Resource could not give us the high-resolution file, and so we couldn't print it. And it was a shame because it was a really wonderful illustrative picture, but, you know, when you can't get it, you can't get it. And we have more trouble, not so much with the stock companies and things like that, but with photographs that are held in private collections and things like that, because you really have to hunt people down. I mean, sometimes I really just pull out the phone book, you know?
Sure. So it's not so necessarily an issue of them saying no. It's an issue of being able to contact them
right,
at all
right.
and get an answer at all.
Right. I mean, for things, we did an article on Elizabeth Catlett and the painter and engraver and whatnot. And she is covered by a group called Vaga International, and it turns out they cover a lot of artists. So it's helpful. They sent me a database of all the artists they covered. So if I have to check, you know, I check there first. And so that's helpful because you just call them up, and it's not cheap, but it's available. You're able to get these things. Often you can also figure out what gallery an artist is represented by, and they're happy to get back to you fairly quickly. Because anything to promote the artist they're working with is a good thing for them. So, but it's like private collections, things like that. I mean, we just did an article on this group of men called the Triple Nickels, they went to paratrooper school during World War II, but they were never actually allowed to be paratroopers. So they were smoke jumpers instead. And the one definitive book was written by an ex-Triple Nickel. And he had a lot of his private pictures in there, but he's passed away. So we couldn't, and we didn't know who to contact or how to get in contact with whoever might have those pictures or might not. You know, so that's where it becomes difficult.
Audrey, I think I'll change focus a little now. That's all been very interesting, but I want to go on to some of the other content of your publication. Mm-hmm. Can you tell our listeners about the Women of Strength and Courage Awards?
Sure, yes. Every year we pick five or six women who we feel have demonstrated, well, strength and courage mostly, in various fields and who have made a vast contribution to Black history and American history and history in general.
I see. And there's now a Men of Honor and Distinction Award ceremony annually as well, correct?
Yes, yes. This will be our second year that we're having. I think it's on November 29th, if I'm not mistaken. And you know, my publisher, Rodney Reynolds, decided that he really felt that, you know, because I always tease him and say, oh, you know, there's always men in the magazine, and, you know, I have to spend a little extra time having more women. And that's just the nature of the beast, because history, you know, most of history is written by men, and, you know, the way culture and history have played out, women have had a great role, but it's not always acknowledged. So, which is why we started also the Women of Strength and Courage. Let's acknowledge these history makers while they're alive. But the Men of Honor and Distinction, it has a different, Rodney Reynolds had a different reason for kind of putting that together, because he really felt that there needs to be reachable mentors for young black men and the youth, young black youth. And they need to be able to have access to them. And what's a component of both of the Women of Strength and Courage and Men of Honor and Distinction is that we do a kind of a panel discussion, workshop type thing with young people in the morning. So they come in, and for an hour and a half or so, the women and Women's Strength and Courage, the men and Men of Honor and Distinction, talk about what they do, and there's a discussion, there's a back and forth. They field questions. They get to come up and talk to these people, you know, one-on-one. We've had a girl get into a college because she spoke with, I can't remember what it was, Nikki Giovanni. It was one of the people who were educators on top of being artists. And because there's that direct one-on-one contact, you know, and the individual was moved by the young girl and her story. We had another young man last year who stood up and said, I just don't have any role models. So ex-mayor David Dinkins was like, well, I'm your role model. Come up here and talk to me and let's get, you know, exchange information. So there's this kind of lovely kind of personal contact that happens, which is my favorite. That's my favorite part of the whole day, is the morning workshops. And then we have the luncheon for the women, and for the Men of Honor and Distinction was an evening kind of affair.
So I get the overall impression that the magazine and these efforts, the real purpose isn't to make money. You have another purpose. I mean, with a $3 cover price, I'm not surprised.
We also don't take liquor or cigarette ads. So my boss made a rule from the start. If we did, I would have a very expensive car. And but we made it. You know, it was a part of his plan that just wouldn't happen. And it isn't about making money. Of course, we all need to eat, we need to have rent, and that sort of thing, but everybody on the staff has an incredible passion for spreading the news and getting the word out and working with the community. We do a lot of events, that health fairs and genealogy workshops and that kind of thing, to, you know, be out there with the community. I mean, I've sat at tables and passed out magazines and that sort of thing. And it's great to meet readers and the public.
Now, that sort of thing isn't the first thing I would associate with Forbes Incorporated.
Right.
Can you tell us about that relationship and how it works and how it benefits your efforts?
Well, sure. First of all, before Rodney was able to make his deal with the Forbes had, for some time, I can't remember when they did, but they purchased American Heritage, which I'm sure you've been familiar with.
Yes.
And so they were already in the business of doing a history magazine. So this wasn't anything that was too foreign to them. In fact, it wasn't foreign at all. And at that time, Tim Forbes was president of American Heritage magazine. He hadn't come over to Forbes to become, I believe he's the COO now there. But don't quote me on that. I haven't looked in my... So they had already had the mechanism in place for producing a history magazine. So when Rodney made his pitch and they realized that they had a ready-made audience and that, hey, this might work, what happened is that it's Forbes, but it was Forbes under the auspices of American Heritage, Inc. So just starting off, they kind of mined the staff of American Heritage and kind of, you know, approached them and said, could one of the senior editors work with Rodney to put together, you know, a test magazine, because they really wanted to test it out first and get a response before they really went full steam ahead. And it went so well that she then took over the editor's position until I got there, and until they realized that, you know, that it was making a profit and that we could have more full staff. And that's when I came on board and the associate editor, et cetera, et cetera.
And my understanding is that American Heritage is being cut loose by Forbes.
Is
that still correct?
Yes, that is still correct.
And how is that?
As far
going,
as I know.
and how is that going to affect you,
well,
or will it? Do you know?
Rodney had already been in negotiations with Forbes well before it was announced that American Heritage was ceasing publication, with buying out their portion of American Legacy. So, and we are at the final stages of that, actually. And so we will be moving to different premises, because right now we're in a Forbes building, not the flagship, but up the street where Forbes.com is. And but we, you know, we will be moving, and we'll be moving forward. The benefits to having worked with the Forbes has been that they do have the resources, everything in place to really get the magazine started. I mean, there's just so many aspects of publishing a magazine that, you know, if you've been doing it for years, it's a breeze. You know? Mm-hmm. And you really do need, venture capital and people who are willing to kind of just commit to, helping you publish a magazine often when it's something that's new and not something that's been in place like an Ebony or an Essence for years and you're just taking it over. So there has been, a tremendous advantage working with them. And it was just, the American Heritage staff and everybody were always really great people. Richard Snow is the editor-in-chief of American Heritage, is somebody I admire greatly, and I've learned incredibly amount. It's been like a post-doctoral program in magazine editing, mm-hmm. working with him. So that's, so the next step is us, cutting loose and moving forward.
Well, I wish your magazine great luck.
Thank you.
Attractive magazine. And believe it or not, our time is nearly up.
Oh, wow. That was great. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
I very much enjoyed talking with you as well, Audrey. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you are interested in subscribing to American Legacy, visit their website at www.AmericanLegacyMag.com. Thank you for listening to this installment of Periodical Radio. I'm your host, Steve Black.